Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a few minutes, New York Times columnist Joe Nocera on why Britain is in a frenzy over the LIBOR scandal, while the U.S. is not, at least not yet. But right now, the shades of gray in when police can stop and frisk you. In the past few weeks, two appellate court judges dropped handgun charges against two teenagers because police officers failed to prove they had reasonable suspicion to stop and frisk them. It's that reasonable suspicion and how to prove it that's become a very gray area in the already controversial stop and frisk policy. WNYC reporter Elsa Chang, who's been covering the story closely, joins us once again to explain. Hi, Elsa.
Hi there.
First, can you tell us what happened in these two cases that resulted in dropped charges for two 14-year-olds, I believe, who in fact had concealed weapons at the time they were searched by police officers?
Sure. The cases the decisions were handed down a week apart, and in both cases, handgun charges were basically reversed convictions were reversed because the judges in both cases felt that there was an adequate reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. In the first case, which was the decision was rendered June 26, it was a 14-year-old boy, African-American in the Bronx, was carrying a black object in his right hand. The officer saw him looking at that black object. The boy looked up at what he thought may have been a police van. It's unsure if the boy recognized the van as a police van because it was an unmarked vehicle. He put the black object in his right pocket, and it was a high crime area. There were gang-related shootings recently in the area. One of the officers went up to the boy and asked him, "What did you have in your right hand?" The boy said, "Oh, my wallet, which is in my back pocket." And the officer tapped his right coat pocket, felt something hard, put his hand in, and it turned out to be a handgun. Now, the majority opinion in that case said, no. All the officer saw was a black object. He was questioned repeatedly during testimony. Did you think it was a gun? Was it shaped like a gun? Over and over, the officer said, "I didn't know what it was. I didn't know if it was a gun." And because of that, the three judges in that case said there wasn't reasonable suspicion.
In other words, just because you see somebody holding something and the thing is black, that is not reasonable suspicion to suspect that it might be a gun.
Well, that's what three judges thought. Two judges in that same appeals panel basically said there was reasonable suspicion. The teenager was acting furtively. He was answering the officer's questions evasively by saying, "Oh, it's my wallet. It's in my back pocket." Clearly, it was a black object. Handguns tend to be black. It was a high crime area. There were related gang shootings in that area recently. They felt that the totality of circumstances in that case actually weighed in favor of the officers.
So that was a split 3-2 decision
exactly. Of
the court. The Daily News ran an editorial last week on these two cases where they wrote about the judges who threw out the charges in very damning terms. They wrote that these three judges, quote, are among really the six judges because it's, I guess, three on one panel and three on another.
There were three judges in each of the cases that voted against the police officer.
Because there were separate 3-2 decisions.
Exactly.
So these judges, quote, are among the many in New York who harbor deep antipathy toward the police. Blinded by ideology, they insist that they are better equipped than officers who patrol the streets every day, their lives on the line, to determine when cops have a reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing and when they don't. And that, quote, judges are risking New Yorkers' lives by barring police from taking even the most reasonable actions to prevent crime. So that's editorial pushback from the Daily News. And it shows the strong feelings on both sides of this.
That's right. There was a lot of editorial pushback. I just want to make one note, though. There have been a lot of characterizations by media outlets after these two decisions that the tide is turning against the NYPD and that these are real blows to the city's stop and frisk policies. Actually, talking to defense lawyers who spend every year challenging individual stop and frisk, about 10% of the stop and frisk that they challenge actually get struck down by appeals courts. So there's nothing unusual, actually, about an appeals court finding an unlawful stop and frisk. It just happens to be the fact that this year, two of the decisions happened within 1 week this summer during a time where the political climate around stop and frisk is so fraught and there's so much controversy. But there's actually no sea change that's happening, according to defense lawyers who are on the front lines.
But in both of these cases, these teenagers went on to commit actual violent crimes. So on a kind of common sense meter, that's going to lead a lot of people to say, wait a minute, something's out of whack here. If the judges are throwing out stops and frisks of people who do actually have guns and do actually wind up going on to commit violent crimes.
And that's right. A lot of the officers I talked to, both current and retired officers, were so angry about these decisions. They were saying, look, these are examples of stop and frisks that work, that did take guns off the street. Remember, just about under 800 guns are taken off the street through stop and frisk, which is about a tenth of a percent of all stop and frisk that happen in the city. And here's the
appeals
court.
That's how unproductive the 684,000 searches, I think that's the number, last year were in terms of the actual point of the program, which is removing illegal
right.
guns from the street.
Well, Bloomberg would argue that's how productive the stop and frisk policy is because it's deterring that many people from carrying their guns out on the street.
0.1% of all those stopped and frisked. I guess if that's still... What's the number? Is it
just under 800 guns.
800 guns.
Yeah.
It's still 800 guns. I want to open the phones for any police officers who may be listening to call in and answer the question, how do you determine in that split second, or maybe it's a few seconds, whether to stop and frisk somebody? Because it is a judgment call. There does have to be reasonable suspicion. But how were you trained in this? And how do you set that reasonable suspicion bar for yourself? For that matter, how do you feel about these court rulings? And do you think it's going to change the way you do your job on the street? Officers, this call-in is for you if we have any of you who happen to be out there right now. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for police officers who use stop and frisk, and our criminal justice reporter, Elsa Chang, our guest. And Elsa, you've talked to both former and current police officers. And for many of them, reasonable suspicion, that term under the law, just doesn't stand up on the street. So let's
right.
take a listen to one of the retired NYPD officers in your piece.
There is no one else to turn to and say, so, what do you think about that ruling of the appellate court? Do you think I should tell him to take his hands out of his pockets so the guns and drugs fall out? While all of that stuff would be nice according to the law, in reality, we must be able to make an instant decision.
Is that the prevalent sentiment today among police officers?
It sure is. That was Joe Gagliardo. He was a retired cop. He was a housing cop during the 80s in Brooklyn South. And, you know, to be fair, the courts have made the reasonable suspicion body of law a little bit unclear. You know, they say that a mere hunch is not enough for a cop to have reasonable suspicion. And the standard is you need reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before you can stop somebody forcibly on the street. That means detain them in such a way where they cannot leave and they must answer your questions as an officer. Now, that means that a reasonably prudent person in that officer's shoes has to believe the person committed a crime, is committing a crime, or will commit a crime. And the courts basically have resorted to analysis that is based on a totality of circumstances. No single factor is sufficient in and of itself in most cases to prove the officer had reasonable suspicion. Instead, it's a composite of factors like a high crime neighborhood. The suspect looked vaguely like a suspect that was described on the police radio. He's a black male teenager wearing baggy jeans. It tended to be it was at night. And, you know, courts have said that later on in the day, when it's later in the day, the level of suspicion gets ratcheted up. The person was moving a little bit furtively. Maybe he crossed the street when he saw the officer, or maybe he quickened his pace when he saw the officer. He was maybe holding something, a bulge in his waistband, his hand was slightly closer to one body than the other arm was, so he was walking a little unnaturally. Courts look at all of these factors, and no one set of factors is the magic set of factors that automatically means reasonable suspicion. And as we saw from these two appeals courts decisions, judges will disagree, 3-2 in each case.
Officers, retired officers, 212-433. WNYC. Patrick in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
My pleasure.
And you're a retired officer?
That's correct.
So what do you want to add?
You inquired, like, how do you determine, you know, whether or not somebody should be stopped? And in my experience, it has nothing to do with someone's really appearance or race, or what it has to do with is the officer's experience. You know, when you gather years and years of experience based on prior arrests, where the person is, what time of the day it is, how they react to you, gives off a flag as to whether or not this person should be stopped and frisked. And it doesn't always start with a stop and frisk. It starts with a question. You know, hi, how you doing, sir? Where are you going today? What are you guys doing around here? And based on those answers and based on how they react to those answers determines how far you go with the stop and frisk. Mm-hmm.
Well, even to start down that road, what makes you even start the conversation and ask somebody, what are you doing around here, where are you going?
It's, you know, it has to do with, the time of the day. You know, if you see someone driving around the block three or four times at 11 o'clock at night in an area where there is activity going on, that you know that from past experience, you know, you say, listen, why are you driving around the block three or four times?
So, you know, you're retired. What do you think of stop and frisk in general, the way it's being administered now, and what do you think of these court rulings?
I think the unfortunate outcome of this is that, you know, you see the amount of shootings have increased in the last month in the city. And what's going to happen, the only thing stopping that person and that gun from going off or being used is that police officer stopping that person and asking him, excuse me, where are you going? What are you doing? And the unfortunate outcome is going to be more bodies in the street, just like there was in the 80s when I was in anti-crime and in narcotics, and we were picking up bodies off the street. And that's the unfortunate outcome of all this.
Patrick, thank you very much. I really appreciate your voice on this. 212-433-9692. So, Elsa Chang, what do you think about the relationship between these two stories in the news? One is all the additional pressure on the NYPD with respect to stop and frisk recently, and this rash of shootings over the last week that Mayor Bloomberg, we heard a clip on the news just at the beginning of the hour, almost throwing up his hand and saying, gosh, well, I hope this is just a blip.
I mean, it is a really, really tough call, basically. I mean, it's the eternal trade-off between safety and civil liberties. We want both, right? But that gray area, that fine line, whether, you know, when police are being aggressive and zealous in their work as police officers, there are a lot of critics out there who say, you know, we would stand for fewer stop and frisks if you can make a better guarantee that you are not, say, racially profiling people. That's a common critique against the stop and frisk policy, that police officers are going up to people just because they're black male in a particular neighborhood. It's a really tough call, because as soon as the crime statistics start rising, people start going up in arms about they want greater police presence, they want to see a show of force. Well, where's the fine line when that show of force goes too far?
Joe in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Brian.
You're an officer, right?
I am. I think rather than be concerned with how we as police will find reason to establish reasonable suspicion, we should look into more the fact that what does the community really want? If you want a police force that is not going to be putting hands on people and looking in people's pockets, and don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for people to have their rights, their civil rights, and the civil liberties to deprive of them. But, you're going to get the kind of policing you want. You know, by outcry and court cases, you'll get the kind of policing you want. But then you have to live with that kind of policing. If you want officers to do nothing, you're going to find that. If you look even with summonses, after that major case with summonses, now it seems in so many respects many officers will not write a summons without direct supervisory influence. You know, the consequences, will show themselves, probably increased accidents maybe. When it comes to things like this, if they feel that the public isn't behind them or the courts will rule so unfavorably against them that they themselves have to have the ability to convey what they observed as though they were an attorney, which they're not, then they're going to be gun shy, for lack of a better word, and they're not going to take action.
Joe, thank you. And that's the exact tension we were talking about a moment ago.
Exactly. And when I'm talking to current cops right now, I mean, they sort of half jokingly say this. You know, they say the best thing Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly could do for themselves is to literally suspend all stop and frisks for like half a year or maybe a year and just see what happens to the crime rates, and then ask people to live in Brownsville and ask people to live in East New York and then tell me how you feel about stop and frisk. You know, I mean, either extreme isn't good, to have overzealous stop and frisk or no stop and frisk. But there is this very constant trade-off that's continually happening. And when you ask critics of the stop and frisk policy, well, how many stop and frisks do you think is ideal every year? If not 685,000, then how many? No one really knows the answer to that question. They just want correct stop and frisks.
Shades of gray. And when police can stop and frisk you, still evolving in light of the recent court decisions. By the way, I just have to mention that Diane Remwick, one of the judges in that Bronx case, happens to be the wife of Bronx DA Robert Johnson, who has worked get guns off the street. And I wonder what that dinner table conversation was like after she overturned that conviction.
I'm sure that's not the only conviction she's overturned involving a gun, or at least I'm sure that's not the only pro-defendant case that she's been on.
Elsa Chang, WNYC criminal justice reporter. We can hear your produced piece on this on our website.
That's right, WNYC.org.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, New York Times columnist and WNYC contributor Joe Nocera on why Britain is in a frenzy over the LIBOR scandal while the U.S. is not, at least not yet.